Okay, Richard, welcome to the podcast. How are you doing, my friend?
I'm good. Thank you very much for having me on board. It's interesting to chat to you.
We've had the chance to interact in person before we've actually ever interacted online. So I
Yeah.
feel, fortunate. It's not usually the case. I usually speak to people
Okay.
for the first time on the podcast, but
Yeah.
it was nice to spend those few days with you guys. We'll actually come back to that. But first and foremost, Richard, for those who don't know you yet, can you tell us a little bit about who you are and what you do?
My name is Richard Laidlow. I am the coach and dad of Sam Laidlow. I've been in the sport of triathlon since I was 14 years old. I am now 50, so I've been around the sport a long, long time. I've been coaching seriously probably from the age of early 20s. Yeah, 21, 22, I started coaching. So I've nearly got sort of just less than 30 years of experience in coaching. And this is what a lot of people don't realize, that I'm not just any dad coaching his son. That's what I do for a living. I'm a full-time professional coach.
Well, talk about your early days in triathlon as an athlete. How did you start in the sport?
I came from a swimming background. I've swum all of my life. It's been I've done sport all of my life. I mean, I was such a pain in the ass on the pool side when I was 3 and a half. My parents sort of just like, bump, get swimming. And that was as much, that's just what he went. So since the age of three, I started swimming properly. I swam to a reasonably high level, in my opinion. I could have probably gone further, but I'd had enough of the actual sport itself. It takes a lot of effort and a lot of concentration to swim, especially as you're going through your teenage years, etc. So I stopped swimming when I was probably 17, and went 18, even probably 17, 18, went straight into triathlon because I was already doing a bit of triathlon as a hobby. I didn't want to stop sport. I just then thought I'll carry on and then go into the triathlon world. I was racing for Great Britain as a junior, or under 21s, I think it was called then, as an elite under 21s. Raced with and trained with people such as Simon Lessing, Richard, Simon Lessing, Spencer Smith, people like that. So I had sort of a good background of people with me. Then at, ooh, I can't remember what age it was, in 93, so I was 20, yeah, 2021. I raced in the under 21s in Manchester, the World Championships. Had a really good race. Probably had one of the fastest runs I had ever done off the bike at the time. So probably at that time was about a sort of a 35-minute 10K off the bike. And 2 weeks later, I was sort of ill. I'd hit sort of overtraining, what we call overtraining syndrome. I was lucky enough to be within the British team and the British squad, so I had the British doctor and everything else looking at and looking at the bloods, trying to treat me. I didn't want to give up the sport, and at the time I was a physical training instructor in the RAF, so that's why I went into. It was natural for me to then to go into coaching and start building from there.
Did the overtraining come from the combination? Were you still swimming at the time, full
No,
time?
I was still swimming because that was part of one of the things in the RAF where triathlon at the time wasn't, or in the military, triathlon wasn't, it was recognized, but it wasn't funded, where swimming was. So I was still doing a lot of swimming for the RAF, but I think it was more to the fact that we were swimming, when I was swimming, we would average between 80, 60, and we would climb up to 120,000 meters in a week. I think that's where my overtraining came from, as well as running 3 times a week and as well as doing weights 3 times a week. Yeah, it's a lot of training for a 200-meter breaststroker and 200 IM swimmer.
That sounds like a tremendous amount of swimming. What is the is that typical nowadays for elite swimmers, or is it high even?
Not that sort of level. No, I mean they still do a lot of high sort of high-ish volume, but I think it really depends on what you do as an event. It's a lot more specific now within it. So if you're a sprinter, then there is no need to be doing that sort of distance. If you're a 200 meter swimmer like me, then you'll do a little bit of distance and a lot of strength work, etc. If you're a long distance swimmer, then obviously, yeah, you'll need to put the miles into the water. You do need to feel the water. You do need to keep hold of that feel of water and understand what you're doing. And that, unfortunately, that just comes with going up and down the pool a lot to keep hold of that feel, to keep hold of that skill.
Yeah, that's something that really sticks out to me is the technical demands of swimming. I'm completely incompetent when it comes to swimming, but
you should have said when we were here, we could have got you in the water.
maybe I could have, but it really sticks out to me as one of the let's say endurance sports or monostructural sports that have the highest technical demands. Would you agree with that?
I do, yeah. I mean, I think it's because you have the medium of water around you. The actual sport itself is not that technical. The biomechanics and everything else, in my opinion, are relatively straightforward. Straightforward. Timing of the stroke is really, really important to get hold of. Yeah, so from a technical side of it, yeah, timing, etc., and that is quite difficult to get that right. I would say fun crawl is probably one of the easiest strokes to get the timing right. But other strokes such as butterfly and breaststroke really take a big demand and really get everything right so everything's flowing in the right direction at the right time.
What's so particular about the medium of water itself versus the air that
we don't live in water, so therefore we don't breathe everything else. You've got to sort of understands it's a bit like if you were deciding to go for a run in the swimming pool. Yeah, your technique would be way, way off. You do things differently. How your body coordination, what you do with your hand in the water and where it actually is so many different. And we get that over and over again within swimmers in triathlon as well. They think they are doing one thing, and actually they're completely doing a different thing. And it's one of the reasons why I do sort of my drills and everything else are there to actually help you coordinate, so you know where your hand is, whereabouts your hand is in the actual water itself. It's not just about doing sort of, I'm doing a catch-up drill to improve my catch. It's more to do actually get the coordination. You get a good swimmer, they can do any drill, and they make you look easy because their coordination is right. Yeah, where you get some people who they look really awkward in the water, and then they look even more awkward when they're doing swimming drills. And it is also really for me, most drills are there to help you coordinate your stroke better than to actually think, oh, I'm placing my hand in that position there, or I'm doing this with my elbow, etc.
So let's put me aside and let's take someone who has some notions of swimming already that spends some time in the pool, whether it's a swimmer or a triathlete, for example. What differentiates a good drill from a bad drill? What can you see and what can you feel when you're doing it, when it's done right versus not?
Well, for me, the drills are placed in there to, I say, help you coordinate. If it's not coordinating or it's slowing your swimming down too much, then it's not really going to help. If it's not really the action, if it's not the action that you do in the water, then I also think it's a pretty bad drill to do. Now, a good drill is something that over exaggerates the motion. If you're looking from a technical aspect to swimming, not a coordination aspect, I would look at something that is over exaggerating that movement. So then, when you're not actually thinking about it, you actually get that movement a lot more natural. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So one of the things that I do with people, or one of the areas I work on, is actually their hand entry and how deep their hand is going into the water. And if ideally what I try and get people to do is put the hands 10 to, let's say, 15 centimeters to 20 centimeters underneath the surface of the water. Yeah. And people put the hands literally half a centimeter under the surface, and they think they're actually at 10, 15 centimeters. Yeah. And it's just that their body doesn't know that. So you've got to over exaggerate the actual action. And for me, that's what makes a good drill, is over exaggerating that movement. So therefore, when you go back to normal, it feels normal.
Because I guess due to buoyancy and the fact that we're going to be pushed towards the surface to some extent, it might feel like we're deeper, but we're
actually absolutely. And it's all about using the proper muscle groups. And obviously, if your hand is understanding basic physics and Newton's third law. Yeah, so every reaction has an equal and opposite reaction. Yeah, it's really understanding that as a basic principle before you can actually do anything.
why should the hand be 10, 15 centimeters below the surface?
There's a number of different reasons. The first one is probably to do with balance. If your hands, people think of balance in the water as an important, balance is an important part. So if you're staying actually streamlined in the water, yeah. So if this is your actual body here, yeah, you've got to stay in that position. Now, if the head's up, yeah, then the feet will drag down. But also what happens if the hands are up, yeah, and your head's in a good position. So if my hands, these are my hands now, you'll still be dragging along in that position there. So the first thing is, obviously, if the hands are slightly down, if they're down in that position, then that will naturally bring the body up into a better streamlined position. The first thing. Second thing is actually engaging the right muscles. Yeah, if the hands are coming, I don't know if you can see, I'll move out. If the hands are in line with the actual shoulder here, yeah, then you're only going to be using a deltoid to catch the actual water, where you're a lot stronger if your hand is 15 to 20 centimeters underneath the surface of the water. You've got a lot more strength there to actually push down because you bring in a bigger muscle group.
Okay, so we're just talking about leverage essentially, and then what you can gather up from underneath the water in that special position. Let's say unnatural position. Would you call it an unnatural position in when you're not used to being in the water?
I wouldn't say it's unnatural. I mean, yeah, anybody being in water is unnatural. Yeah, it's not something where we live permanently. Right. Yeah, people have a bath, less and less people have a bath now, and then sort of more and more people have a shower. So you don't really play around with water as much. Yeah, and it's understanding. And they say that as me from a child, we used to just play in the pool all the time. And I think that's one of the things that actually gets you a lot more confident. So I think the confidence in the water is sort of why people don't have that. They want to keep their head as high as possible to make sure they're actually breathing as quickly as possible so that they get enough air into them. Yeah. And again, it's sort of actually, that's what is a lot, quite often more detrimental to a swimmer is they're trying to breathe too often. And it's not natural to them. And again, when we have I get novice swimmers coming out to us here who really struggle to swim, it's because they're actually over-breathing, they're hyperventilating in the water. They're sort of trying to get as big a breath in as you possibly can. I mean, that's what we were talking about when you were here with us, sort of not trying to get rid of the carbon dioxide, the sort of panic and take the biggest breath as they possibly can and just start sort of getting dizzy. And it doesn't help. It's all about relaxing.
Is there something to do as well with, I guess, the buoyancy aspect of swimming? And if you take too big a breath, you're going to maybe empty too much, and that might change your position in the water. Is there anything to this?
Yes, I'm sure it does. But most people, I think about it, if they try and breathe, literally, if they're breathing every other stroke, so every two strokes, they're breathing about 60 times a second. Yeah. sorry, 60 times a minute. Sorry. Yeah. So it's a lot of breathing. We don't need to breathe that much. Yeah. And so therefore, it's about sort of actually just cutting, making a shorter breath, and actually breathing as naturally as you possibly can. Yeah. If that means breathing every four strokes, breathing every six strokes while you're swimming easy, then that's a good way to actually get you to actually relax itself.
Yeah, because I guess being relaxed and finding your your grips in the water is a very important part of swimming.
Yeah, absolutely. If you're tense in the water, you're not going to swim well. You've got to be as relaxed as you possibly can. And I think that's same in all sports, to be honest. I mean, if you look at a good runner, they look as though they're floating along because they're relaxed. They're not sort of tense, grimacing the whole time along. They might be for the last 100 meters or so. And it's the same in swimming. If you can't see them, visually see them. So then you can tell when their muscles are sort of rigid and solid and they're trying to fight against the actual water itself, not work with the water. And it's the same on the bike. If you look at Sam on the bike from Kona, it was fluid. It was poetry watching that, and he made it look easy, even though he was pushing out 315, 320 watts. It made it look as though it was easy, and that's the key. I think you've just got to relax into all of the sports.
To a trained eye like yours, what does a relaxed swimmer look like in the water versus a tense swimmer?
It's just a lot more fluid. Their movement in the stroke is a lot more fluid. Yeah, it's just very sort of, there's no pause in their stroke, there's no splashing, there's no sort of throwing the arm then stopping and holding. It's just about, and also how they actually float in the water. For me, when I actually see people swim, I can see that more when they actually come to the end of the pool. I can see it when they're swimming, because obviously I've been swimming a long time, I can analyze people more or less straight away. But when they come to the end of the pool, and they've only just done the warm-up, Yeah, it's sort of about actually being able to go, okay, no, I can swim slowly. And one of the things I try and teach people is to be able to swim 400 meters as easy as they were walking 400 meters. And then you know somebody's relaxed. And it sounds easy, but it's not as easy as it sounds.
Yeah, I heard that swimming slowly and well was something that was quite
challenging. Yeah, absolutely.
Let's talk about triathletes specifically, rather than swimmers.
Yeah, absolutely. Swimmers.
What are the most common mistakes that you see made by people trying to swim better?
People trying to swim better is they swim too much. They swim far too much in the water itself. They're swimming on a daily basis or five times a week, six times a week, and they're not letting their body actually recover in between. And then the sessions are also relatively short, so they try and squeeze their sessions into a sort of a very 45-minute slot. I mean, unfortunately, COVID didn't help this. Mm. Yeah, so when in the UK, in a lot of places, they would actually have slots that you had to swim in. And they might be sort of an hour slot, but you only got 4 to 5 minutes because they had to do their changing and then cleaning the pool, et cetera, et cetera, before the next group came in. Mm-hmm. And therefore, people were condensing their swimming as much as they possibly can. And it's not always about that. With Sam, we're sort of, I'm a big advocate of just doing sort of bigger, longer sessions, but not swimming as much. So he comes out of the water and my athletes come out of the water with their arms sort of dragging along the ground. They're not being cardiovascular. So then therefore, it's going to take a good 48 hours to recover before they can actually swim again properly or well.
Right. So people should swim a little bit less.
Yeah, in general. A little bit less. For me, a little bit less, a little bit longer per session. I would much rather see somebody do three swim sessions, even two swim sessions a week that were actually really focused and their arms were falling off when they're coming down. It's a bit like doing sort of a weight session or a weight training or CrossFit, everything else like that. You don't do a hard session and then the next day or the next morning do another hard session and the next day do another hard session. Yeah, the body can't cope with it.
And I guess you have in triathlon, you have to balance that out with the bike and the run.
Yeah, as well. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. That's why I like swimming to be very muscular orientated. Mm-hmm. I don't want it to be, it will be cardiovascular, but we get the cardiovascular side of it again from running and cycling. But also, so we've got that side. But from an upper body point of view, especially for triathlon, it is quite, you have to be strong in the water to swim well. If you look at the standard swimmer, they're pretty big.
Okay, that's an interesting one. So would you say that there's going to be a significant difference in the content of sessions between a triathlete swimming and then a swimmer swimming?
Well, yeah, I mean, the stroke's completely different. I teach completely different strokes when you swim in open water for open water swimming to pool swimming. Pool swimming, I would say, is a lot more precise, and you have to have a bigger skill level to be able to be hydrodynamic through the pool. The water's smooth, it's calm, etc. Yeah, you still need to be strong to get the arms turning to catch that actual water. But realistically, in open water, the water's coming from all different directions. You're getting hit here, you're getting hit there, where you need to be. For me, you want to be as stable as you possibly can. If the body's stable in the water, then you can actually keep on turning your arms. Mm-hmm. It's one of the things I learned in the forces. We used to canoe a lot. And if you do any white water canoeing sort of slalom and things like that, you have to keep your arms turning, you have to keep the pedal turning around, because if not, you're over. Yeah, and it's the same thing really with swimming. When you're open water, you're not going to turn over, but you are going to slow down a massive amount. So it doesn't matter how quick you turn your arms or how long you turn your arms over, but it is consistent and being very stable in the water at the same time.
That's a really good topic. What are the main mistakes that people make when they're used to swimming in the pool and then they go out into the open water?
Obviously, every coach is different in how they teach. Now, a lot of triathletes will go to swimming coaches, or there's a lot of swimming coaches that do triathletes at the same time and don't really, for me, understand the actual what the actual stroke is about for open water. Because that's not where they actually have taught. They've not learned in that actual area. Yeah, so it is very much sort of, obviously, swimmers, you're looking at hydrodynamics a lot more than you are for a triathlete. Mm-hmm. Your arm turnover in it, for me, in open water, can be quite a bit higher So therefore you are literally just turning your arms around as much as you possibly can to keep yourself as stable. And if somebody hits it, then that stroke doesn't really matter that much. Yeah. Right. Where if you're doing a very long, smooth, nice looking stroke in the pool, yeah, and you try and do that in open water and suddenly you get hit from the left or you get hit from the right or both at the same time, then you've just lost sort of 3-4 seconds of swimming. Yeah, where if your arm turnover is a lot quicker, then obviously you can that arm then is already pulling, so it doesn't really matter as much. So for me, I would say that there it is to do with the hydrodynamics and the arm turnover. Don't go for a long, smooth, beautiful looking stroke. You still need to do a long, smooth as training. Yeah. Yeah, but when you're actually coming into racing and the sort of specific stuff we do for racing, it can't be that way.
You talked about hydrodynamics. What's the influence of the swimsuits that the triathletes wear nowadays in the water?
The wetsuits are quite good. A good fitting wetsuit, and this is more to do with buoyancy than anything else.
Yeah.
And it helps. So a good fitting wetsuit, I would say, would look around about improving your time by about 10 seconds, 100. Yeah. If you put a wetsuit on and you're looking at about 3 or 4 seconds or even the same time as what you're doing without a wetsuit on, there's two things. Either the wetsuit's badly fitting, yeah, or your stroke is too pool orientated.
Okay, so if you shouldn't swim like you're in the pool.
No, not really. Unless you're swimming by yourself and you're perfectly smooth, yeah, which is a very rare thing in the sport of triathlon.
So you talked about the fact that you transitioned to coaching triathlon. Was that because you were in the sport? Did you have a particular interest for the discipline at the time?
Yeah, I mean, it was. I mean, I was still coaching. I was a physical training instructor anyway in the military. So I was teaching people to be to do circuit training. I was teaching athletes. I was teaching, yeah, keeping the military fit, doing a lot of circuit training, doing a lot of sports, sort of rugby, basketball, things like that. And also doing, well, I mean, it's called CrossFit now, but we used to call it UltraFit. So doing a similar sort of thing that sort of where you actually set up a circuit where you go on from one onto the other, come back round and things like that. So that's sort of the background that I taught. But obviously, I was a reasonable level swimmer and I was a reasonable level triathlete. And at that time, there's very few coaches within the actual sport of triathlon. And so what happened was when you get a good athlete who can't train, yeah, and I still wanted the time off work. So obviously I still wanted to go to the training camps. So the best way to do it was to actually stand on the pool side or stand on the side of the track or go out cycling sort of thing with them.
Mm-hmm. What were the early mistakes that you made as a triathlon coach?
Not having a coach. Oh, sorry, as a coach. As a coach. It's difficult because, I mean, you evolve. I mean, what I do is I listen, I watch. I'm very, very observant. I love listening to other coaches. I love watching other coaches on the pool side or on the running track and listening to what they do, listening to podcasts, listening to sort of YouTube and just picking information up. And it's always evolving. And yes, even in science, I mean, obviously when you sort of lactate acid, and look at that sort of theory behind it, and looking at how, so, okay, your body's producing lactic acid, that burning is that you, yeah, it sort of changes the whole aspect of that. It evolves. So what mistakes did I make? I don't know. It's very difficult to say. But obviously, the sport as a coach, that you need to evolve. I'm coaching completely different now to what I was sort of 20 years ago. I'm coaching completely different now than I was 10 years ago because everything adapts. And as a coach, you need to understand and actually take that forward.
Okay, so let me rephrase that. So you obviously had a strong suit in swimming, given your background and your experience. Which discipline from the bike and the run took the most time for you to get comfortable with up to this?
Well, it's funny because I think swimming is one of the hardest ones to change in people. Mm. Yeah. It's in a different medium. It's difficult and people struggle to learn. I think I really enjoy coaching running, and I really enjoyed coaching cycling as well, because they were relatively straightforward. How you can change somebody, how you can actually improve them from a technical aspect, not from a fitness aspect. From a swimming aspect, yes, I will probably give more mileage to people. And obviously, from my swimming background, it was you were I would do bigger sessions, but probably more speed orientated, and mm-hmm. just expecting. And obviously, within yourself, sort of certain coaches, I would be like, or not certain athletes, I'd be like, sort of, well, what do you mean you can't do 200 meters butterfly? Everybody can do 200 meters butterfly. Yeah, that sort of thing. And I suppose as a coach as well, when I was younger, I think I was probably a bit more aggressive. Probably trying to prove that I knew what I was doing more than anything else. And obviously, as you get older and as you get more and more experience, you get more and more confidence in what you're doing, and therefore you don't need to be. Yeah, and it's like now I can tell people to do things if they it's up to obviously it's up to them if they want to do it or not. Yeah, it's not up to me if they do it or not. Whereas a kid, obviously, I think all sort of younger coaches, sort of young. Well, coaches that teach squads or schools or anything else like that, they tend to shout a huge amount, and that's what my experience was as an actual as an athlete, where they're telling you to do something, you're not doing it, why aren't you doing this sort of thing. And obviously that then comes across as well at the same time as my experience, but obviously as I've got older, I've probably mellowed out a bit.
Yeah, I like to say that I'm not in the business of convincing. If somebody yeah. needs convincing to do something, then they can go and see, listen to someone else if they want to, because
yeah, it's one of the that's one of the things that I find quite interesting, because it sort of there's different people believe or understand things differently, and if somebody isn't convinced at the start, for me, I then try and change the way I'm actually talking, or the methodology I'm actually trying to teach them, and see if they then understand it that way. A lot of the time it's because they're not convinced because they don't understand. Yeah. And it's sort of learning how to get somebody to understand, and I think that's for me as a coach is one of the biggest things, and probably one of the big I sort of change my methodology of coaching depending on the actual athlete yeah that you have in front of you. I might give three or four different methods of the same thing, and one of them hopefully would click, and the others just don't. Yeah, and so as soon as an athlete understands that, then they can then pick and choose what actually helps them or works with them.
Have you had situations where you just can't find a line of communication?
Oh yes. Oh yeah, yeah. I mean, in everything. I mean, there is. It's like sort of you can talk to people. You can explain till you're blue in your face, and if they're not willing or they don't want to, then there is no point. And I have that in a number of sort of athletes. Obviously, people who come out on training camps. Yeah, I'm here to help them. Yeah, at the end of the day, I will try as hard as I can to help them, but if they're not willing to accept that help, then there's nothing you can do.
So when you do encounter such a situation, how do you usually operate? How do you navigate it?
Well, normally I'll just let them carry on doing what they're doing. Mm. Yeah, especially if they're out on camp, because obviously it can be a bit awkward. I think I've had two people in the 22 years, 23 years here in coaching where I've literally said, I can't deal with them. Yeah. So that's more, say, as well as a personality clash, that's more to do with the fact that they're not, in my opinion, not helping themselves, and they don't want to be helped. But again, it's a rare thing. I'll always adapt to them if they want to carry on doing that, if they want to carry on training. I mean, obviously, a lot of people who come out to us have on training camps also have a coach in the background. Yeah, so and I'm there as an actual support. I'm not there to say, oh, your coach is wrong, et cetera, et cetera. So quite often I'll just stand back and just guide them through what they're meant to be doing. And that's one of the ways I learn as well is, obviously, we've had probably thousands of people out here on camp, and I've coached and dealt with probably all of those. Mm. Yeah, so the learning ability that I have, the resource of material that I've had from different people is incredible, and it's a privilege to be able to say that I've actually had helped this person, or I've done this, or I've seen this, and learned at the same time. Yeah, it's not me about telling them what to do. I'm learning off everybody who comes out.
You mentioned being fairly aware of what is done, what is said within your ecosystem from the very beginning, listening to other coaches, seeing what you can gain from other people and learn and then implement. How has the overall philosophy of training in triathlon evolved since you started in the discipline, from your point of view?
From my point of view, philosophy, I mean, I mean, a lot of people, what's your philosophy in training? But again, it's not something I like to say, oh, this is my philosophy, because it isn't. Again, it adapts from one person to another, depending on how they're doing. I mean, for me, sort of, the training now is way, way more scientific. And there is a big understanding. Now, that could be because I'm coaching Sam. Yeah, and coaching other pro athletes who are at that level, who are at that cutting edge level. Mm. Yeah. Before, and when Sam was younger, I mean, I only coached Sam since he was sort of 19. I've helped him throughout the actual sport itself. But it's not something I've always wanted Sam to actually have other coaches, because I was coached by my dad. Mm. Yeah. And I know the sort of the relationship, sort of the issues you can have as an actual relationship between. So, the adapting of the sport, I'd say, has got a lot more scientific. And obviously we can see this sort of circular action, where when I was first started coaching, we were looking sort of as Phil Maffetone, the Maffetone method of sort of training, where keeping low heart rates and going no sort of interval work, et cetera, and then we started going back into sort of doing a lot of interval work, a lot more specific, and then going into sort of HIIT. And then now coming back down to, with Pogačar and all the sort of the cyclists now, right, it's all back down to zone two training. Mm. Yeah. And so there's this circular sort of, at the moment, where it's sort of a wave action that's going through in coaching at the moment.
Yeah.
Yeah. And for me, I don't think there's one method for every single person. So not everybody should be going out and doing HIIT. Not everybody should be going out and doing sort of zone two training. It depends on their physiological state. And once you know their physiological state, and also most people aren't pros. They do it because it's relaxing. It's a hobby. Yeah. And it's what they enjoy. And if they hate doing zone two work or keeping their heart rate under 130 beats per minute for 6 hours at a time sort of thing, then what's the point of doing it? It's not going to be enjoyable. Mm. Yeah. So from that, yeah, there is always, I say, going back to sort of philosophy, it's always changing in the world of the sport itself. But at the moment, I think it's very close to where it was when I first started, which is looking at sort of doing a lot of zone two work.
So the pendulum has swung back.
Yeah.
That's really interesting. For amateur triathletes at large, do you see a parallel between what you said before with the swimming and the rest of training? Are people training too much relative to their recovery capacity, or?
Yeah. I mean, they're probably training too, I wouldn't say too much, they're training too hard for what they actually need. You do need to train hard. Yeah, but there is a different hard. It's not sort of coming out of a session and sort of feeling absolutely fantastic because you've just nailed yourself to the floor. Yeah. For me, that was a circuit training when we used to take circuit training. So if we did a correct training session, you would say in circuits, everybody would come out and go, oh, it's boring, wouldn't it? Yeah. And it's not easy. The way you absolutely kill them on the ground and they're crawling out of the gym, and they're actually, oh, that's the best session I've ever done in my life, sort of thing. Yeah. And so it's sort of, yeah, I would say that they do that in training too much. They don't understand that they actually need to be doing a lot more specific work that is quite boring and monotonous. Yeah. But at the same time, will help them actually develop. But as an amateur, as a sort of a weekend warrior, they've got to do it to enjoy it. So if they enjoy doing that sort of thing, then we need to carry that on, yeah, and try and adapt them slowly to do that. But majority of my athletes, including sort of Sam and my other sort of pro athletes, they do a lot less than everybody else that is out there at the moment.
How do you explain that?
My training is very, very specific, and it's about absorption. You've got to absorb training. So, and also they're developing, you're developing as an athlete. I'm looking for long-term, not short-term. So, okay, yeah, great. I've got six Sam or any athlete on sort of 30 hours a week, and you'd see a good improvement. There will also be high getting ill, high injury rates, et cetera, and it's not about that. I'd much rather look at it from a long progression over sort of a minimum, sort of really a four-year window of what we're actually looking at and develop somebody. Now, if Sam at the moment, who's 24, yeah, for example, was doing 35 hours a week, yeah, how then would he progress? Yeah, obviously, you have to keep on doing an overload principle, Yeah, so that overload principle is getting further and further and further. So he, by the time he was, say, 28, 29, he might be up to 40 hours a week. But how far can you actually go until you can't? Yeah, because it's all about the actual recovery itself. So it, for me, it's a lot more about using other areas and still them coming out. And again, looking at strength orientated, you need to be very, very strong. Muscular endurance is a key part of, especially Ironman. You need to, yes, your endurance is. Yeah, but I know Sam can ride 180K. I know he can go out tomorrow and run 42K, no issues at all. So how do we make it so he's actually more efficient and get his strength there? Because it is, at the end of the day, a strength sport. And I think you're seeing that with the stand, the size of athletes now. Yeah, and I don't mean going out and doing CrossFit and going out and doing a weights training session. I'm a lot more specific in what they're actually doing. And so therefore, the training session is orientated about trying to increase the number of mitochondria or trying to recruit the number of muscle fibers. Yeah, or say with swimming, getting there so that the actual shoulders are falling off because the arms are tired. Yeah, and that's the same if we're without putting in, okay, yes, I could send them out for a 10-hour bike and their legs are going to be tired at the end of it. Yeah, but could I do that in 3 hours? Yeah, or 4 hours? And therefore, their body can sooner recover. And therefore, then they can sooner train again at a higher intensity.
Yeah, because I guess the volume is just another stimulus, just like any other one.
Yeah, and absolutely.
If you apply too much too early, you'll see the improvements, but you might rob the athlete of that future improvement they could have gotten later on.
Yeah, and obviously you have a plateau. People will hit this plateau, and it's trying to change that. But again, if you again rack up your training, yes, your improvement's going to be very, very quick. But then suddenly it will soon plateau out. And then what do you do to try and improve that? Yeah.
So how do you determine that the current load of training has been maximized, quote unquote, and now you have to apply that extra volume to keep moving forward? How do you make that decision versus, no, we can still squeeze some juice out of what we're doing now, whatever volume that we're applying right now? How do you?
I mean, I'm lucky with from Sam's perspective. He understands his body very, very well, and I do with a lot of my athletes. Mm-hmm. They understand them. So if they feel that that it's not going as well as what it should be, yeah, or they're feeling that they're stagnating, or they feel that they're from session to session, then we'll feedback, we'll sit down, we'll talk about it. It's not about me dictating to them what they're actually doing. Yeah, it's about us as an actual partners working together to understand. And it's one of the things with my athletes, I want them to talk to me as much as they possibly can to tell me how the actual training is. Not just the numbers, their numbers that we get are just part data. But if Sam comes out and goes, oh, I think that might be a good session to do, well, let's try that session, see if that works. Is there any stimulus in that? Does it actually work? Has he got legs? Can we take that on? And it's the same with my other athletes. If they're saying, oh yeah, but I could we try and do this, or can we do that? Yeah, it is a partnership. It's not me dictating what they give me an idea, and then we all can work with that and I adapt that the best possibly can into the actual training. Again, it's my methodology within training adapts to every single person. Yeah, and I think that's the actual key. It's not me dictating to them, you've got to do this, you've got to do that, you've got to do this. They might come across them and go, oh, can we do something like this? I think, and I said, no, I don't want you to do that because of this. Yeah, or it might have that effect on. Mm. Yeah, but if I think it's got a little bit, then we'll say, okay, let's give it a go, see how it feels, and let's get the feedback, and I can see the dates and see if it helps. And that's how I develop as an actual coach. Yeah, it's not me telling, oh, we're doing this. Because if that was the case, I'd still be doing what I was doing sort of 10 years ago. Yeah, yeah, and sort of following that through. No, you've got to evolve as a coach. You've got to evolve with your actual athlete and listen to what they're saying more so than sort of just going, right, okay, this is what we're doing today.
What are some of the favorite questions that you like to ask your athletes to get that feedback that you're looking for as a coach?
And one of the things is basically, what would you like to do? Yeah, most of the athletes, a lot of athletes don't. They will develop, and I, as a coach, I give feedback on a daily basis. Yeah, I don't know how normal that is for people, but either if I don't see them on a regular basis, then I get them to give me feedback through training peaks. Yeah, or they can send me a message and stuff. So those questions, I wouldn't say there's any favorite questions. They are just observations that they sent or feelings that they sent, and then we actually send that through. Yeah, I have people that literally don't feel anything, and I'm sending them a message saying, rest for 3 days. Don't do anything. Except because they're just sort of blindly going into it and just going, okay, no, coaches said me to do this, or coaches told me to do this sort of thing. And it's not, it is about sort of, for me, really listening to what the athlete feels and understands. And it's the same as a coach, I'm there to help educate them. So I tell them why they're doing something. And if they feel that, if they understand why they're doing something, they're a lot more susceptible to doing it. But also, if they feel that it's not actually working that way, they've probably got more chance to tell me, say, oh, gee, no, I don't think that's working as well as what this session did or that session did. And then we can adapt.
What, on average, would you say that triathletes today are more aware of their, I guess, their, how developed their perception is of themselves and their efforts versus 15 or 20 years ago?
No, probably not. No, I don't think so. Main reason is 15, 20 years ago, we might have a heart rate monitor that only a few people actually had. We didn't really have GPS watches. GPS watches were just coming in. Power meters weren't around. So how do you give feedback? It was about feel and perception of what was actually happening. So no, I don't think so. I think now in sport, in the world, the computers they have on their wrists and on their bikes and everything else are dictating to them what they're actually doing. It's getting sort of, and again, we see this with sort of AI coming into coaching. Sort of AI coaching, where it's not anybody that's actually developing, they're just taking the results and developing that through. They're developing that on. It's not real sort of life. And one of the keys for me is to see people in the flesh and to see them in the eyes and see how tired they really are. What the data can tell you can be completely different to what their actual mannerisms can tell you.
So data really has to be used as an add-on to the rest and not a substitute.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think all data, I think it does give us markers. Things like sort of the HRV are really important, but again, you've got to take it with a pinch of salt. We've had cases where the sort of people's HRV is really bad and they're actually done some of the best sessions they've ever done. And so it's either they've come into it because the HRV has been low, they've actually probably gone into it really relaxed and produced really well, where they're thinking, oh, I should be flying today because my heart, and they've had a really bad session. There is always a bit, but I think any sort of biomarkers or heart rate, power, anything that can help you understand lactate is an important thing. If you can get that, use that. It can be influenced, so can heart rate, so can the power, so everything is influenced. But at the end of the day, if you've got that data and you've got them as an actual athlete, you can see a lot more, a bigger picture of what is actually happening.
Is there any instances where you'll take away some metrics in order for people develop their perception?
Yeah, quite often. I've got one athlete at the moment who was a very, very good runner. And now all he's doing is, my run's rubbish because I was at this pace. My run's rubbish at this pace. So it's literally, so I've taken it away completely and just used a rate perceived exertion. And really sort of, I don't really want you to wear a watch. I need to see that watch. But I'm not setting you any paces or setting you anything. I just want you to go out and run at that and how you actually feel. And see where that data goes. I've got a few athletes like that. And some people prefer to coach like that. So I'm quite happy. If an athlete comes to me and goes, oh, no, I don't have a GPS, I don't have this, I don't have that, I've got a stopwatch, and I'm like, well, that's fine. It's not a problem with me. But you'll have to give me more old school feedback of the actual session itself, because I haven't got that data. But I'm quite happy to coach like that. I quite like it.
Do you sometimes then go back to more tech and more information and try to blend them together again, or do you usually stay?
No, I'll blend them back again, and that's what I'm doing. That's what I'm doing with this athlete at the moment. We're starting to slowly bring back in the actual data so he can actually see. And a lot of times, like me as an athlete, when I was a swimmer, I get into the water and go, oh, that's terrible. How can I be swimming so slow? It's because I haven't been in the water for like 3 years. And it's the same. Okay, when I was 15, or when I was 18, when I was 22, I was running sort of 32-minute 10Ks. Yes, possibly. But now I'm a lot older. You're a lot older. You have a lot more niggles. You've got a family. You've got work to do. Everything else. You can't expect to do that. And it's only until they sort of accept where you are at that moment. That you can actually start using that data as best you can.
Mm-hmm. You talked about family, and as you've mentioned, you coach Sam, and you also coach Jake, your other son. What are the upsides and the downsides of coaching your own children?
To be honest, I don't think there's any downsides. Again, it's my job to be a coach. Yeah, and I think that's what's actually important. I think it's very, very difficult for parents or to be sort of not a coach and go, oh, there's a gap in the window there where I can actually help them and sort of start learning. Yeah, I've got that experience beforehand to bring into them. And it's one of the things with Sam, as I said before, I didn't really want to coach Sam until he was ready to be coached. Yeah, I didn't want to force myself on him. The upside sort of for the coaching side of it is I get to see them both on a daily basis. Yeah, so I'm on the pool side with them. They are here the whole time. We have Archer. You never met Archer as well. Also, who's another pro triathlete who's now living in the house. And since he's been living with us, yeah, the progression has been big because I can see on a daily basis what he actually needs. Yeah, how is he feeling? Yeah, does he need me to say this or does he need me to say that? Yeah, and I think it makes a big difference when you're in that sort of environment. As long as they're happy, yeah, then obviously everything's going along. And again, if they go into a session and they're in a bad mood or miserable, is there any really point to doing that actual session? I'd much rather than be sort of a happy side of it. And that becomes, I'm not a pushy coach. Like with Jake, who's 14, I will train him because I know he can be very, very good. But at the moment, he's 14, so he doesn't need to be training the same as what Sam does. Yeah, he just needs to be ticking over, maintaining what he's actually doing, and then also enjoying life as any 14-year-old should be doing. Yeah, going out and playing rugby, going out on his motorbike, things like that. That's what it's about, and it's prioritizing. Yeah, a lot of parent coaches, they are pushing their kid from a very young age. And okay, they're very, very good when they're 14, 15, 16. But when they're 24, 26, 28, they're just not there anymore. They've given up the sport because they've been pushed too much, or they've had too much. They've been pushed too much, I'd say, is the best way of doing it. And they don't love the sport anymore.
Yeah, that's something that was very apparent in how Jake is still fully free to decide whether he wants to play rugby, maybe he wants to triathlon, but he's not sure. And there was really no pressure at all from your guys' side. The door is open, right? But there's no, oh, you need to do this because I am who I am, or because Sam is who he is, or anything like that. It's really, you're 14, live your life. And then if you want to do sports with us, come and do sports with us. And whatever happened in the future will happen.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think any parent really needs to be able to do that. They need to let you'd want to do this. Yeah, if they're enjoying it, push that. I mean, I was at the lake the other day. It was 2 days ago doing a run session. And there was other athletes there running. And there was a girl running past me crying her eyes out, being pushed. And I'm like, sort of, that's just not right. Yeah, it's not right. It's not right. You shouldn't be a 15, 16-year-old girl crying her eyes out training because you've been pushed to actually train. That's just misery. A kid needs to have fun. And obviously it's like, so people right from the word go, when we had Jake, because there's a big gap between Jake and Sam, it's a 10-year gap between them. Mm-hmm. So it's always, Jake going to be a triathlete? Well, I don't know if he's going to be a triathlete or not. He might be a computer geek. I don't know. It's what he wants to do. Yeah. I'm not there to push him because I failed at being a triathlete or I failed at being a swimmer. I want to push them into the sport because they're going to be better than me. Obviously, I mean, for me, I think it's logical that you support the children to do what they want to enjoy, yeah, but keep them actually active. And more and more, I think children are, children, adolescents and sort of teenagers and that are just getting more and more enthralled into sort of their phone and, oh, no, that's what I like doing is looking at their phone. Oh, that's what I like doing. So they don't do anything outside of that. So they still need to be encouraged in doing other things outside of where they are.
How do you optimize, or do you even think about Jake's training load as a teenager? Is that something you keep an eye over? Is it pretty free and open and pretty light in general?
No, it's quite free and open. I mean, I'll train. So like Jake, he'll do weight training for me at the moment. Jake does weight training on a Monday night because he enjoys doing weights for rugby. He then does rugby on a Tuesday night. He swims and runs with us on a Wednesday, has Thursday as a day off. Friday he does rugby training. Saturday either has a rugby match or we do a cycle or a run, and then Sunday we do the opposite. We either do a swim and a cycle or a run, depending on what he's doing. But at the end of the day, if I come in and I can see Jake's tired and not getting anything out of the swim session, I'll stop him, even if it upsets him. Yeah, I will stop the session because it's what I call flogging a dead horse. You're not getting anything out of it. And if you're not getting anything out of the session, what's the point of actually doing it other than fatiguing yourself? I'd much rather him sit on the side of the pool or go and do something else to actually recover, yeah, and sort of relax and keep him as a whole person, not sort of down, oh, yeah, I had a bad session, I didn't end up, my dad kicked me out of the pool today, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. For a teenager who's still in school, what do you think of double days, waking up very early, training early in the morning, and then training after school? In what case is it warranted in any case from your perspective?
Well, I mean, that's what I did. Even I went away to a swim school. But I would get up at 5 o'clock in the morning, we'd swim, and then we'd do swim, we'd finish swimming, we'd go to school, we'd come back. If your body's recovering enough, and again, it comes back to absorption, depends on the stress of the school, depends on the stress of how much travel, everything else. If your body's absorbing it and you enjoy doing it, then why not? Yeah. But again, at the same time, you've got to look at the progression. If I'm sort of 12-year-old, 11-year-old, 12-year-old, I'm training twice a day already, yeah, that progression is, where's that going to go? And then suddenly you come to sort of university and everything else comes in, and then you come into a job and the job takes over, then it sort of disappears. Yeah, that to be able to do that. Mm. Now, both my children, from a very, very young age, they wanted to be professional sports people. Yeah, so therefore we know that that's the line that they want to take, and we'll carry them going through there. Yeah, Sam from a very, very young age wanted to be, wanted to win Kona from sort of under 10-year-old. That I want to win Kona. That's my goal. Yeah, that's what I want to do. We go to the careers advice at school. Okay, what do you want to do for a living? I want to be a professional triathlete. And what else do you want to do? No, that is my job. Yeah, and even now we still get questions. Oh, what studies does Sam do? He doesn't do any studies because he's a professional triathlete. He doesn't need to. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's the same with sort of Jake's always wanted to be a professional athlete. He didn't know what athlete he wanted mm-hmm. to do. He's gone through doing motocross. Yeah. Going onto mountain biking, rugby, football. Yeah. All of those. And somewhere along that line, he'll find what he wants to do. And we've always, as parents, have always sort of gone, right, okay, I would like him to carry on swimming. I would like him to carry on cycling. I'd like him to carry on running. Because then he's got a choice. Mm. Yeah, where if he stopped and just focused on rugby and in 2 years' time, yeah, he goes, oh, I don't like rugby anymore. Yeah, then he's lost 2 years of that sort of adaptability, yeah, to carry on going. And we had the same thing with Sam. Yeah, Sam sort of, when he was younger, he never really enjoyed running running at all. It's always his weakness. Oh, I want to be a pro cyclist. I'm going to be a pro cyclist. Yeah, okay, you can be a pro cyclist. Yeah, if you want to be a pro cyclist, but I want you to carry on still swimming and running, yeah, to complement the actual cycling, but then also carry that going. Because if you stop running now, or you stop swimming now and just focus on cycling, and you find that cycling isn't for you, which he did find out that cycling wasn't for him, yeah, then what happens to the sport? What happens to his career as a sport, as an athlete? Yeah, mm-hmm. It disappears.
How do you manage switching sports or exploring different sports as a youngster? Do you have a minimum of, if you commit to this, you need to be in it for at least a year before we move on? Is there a lot more flexibility?
How
do you find the balance between the two?
No, there's a lot more flexibility. Jay, a lot of it is to do with sort of where your friends are. And if your friends are going to go down that, I mean, we're privileged where we live at the moment and stuff. There's a huge amount of opportunities to try everything. Yeah, so why not? It's not something that, okay, you try this, okay, we'll buy your equipment for a year, then a year later it stops. Yeah, he'll still go back into that. I mean, he was really into sort of mountain biking. He's quite a good mountain biker. Yeah, there was a small club here. But then sort of the club sort of disintegrated. Okay, yes, we've just bought a bike, or we bought a mountain bike, an expensive mountain bike. Yeah, but that's still there and he still uses it, etc. Mm. That sort of goes into the same thing. I mean, rugby is great. He goes out, goes and sees his friends and stuff like that. It's all about being social, especially at that age. The more social somebody is at that age, the better they'll be able to develop, I feel, when they get older.
What are the main challenges that you see for teenagers in sports today that would prevent them from either developing like they could or reaching their potential later in life?
The two areas that I look at are or the experience that I've had, our parents is one of the biggest things. Their parents are pushing them too much. Their parents are pushing them too much. Their parents are pushing them too much. And I think what I've had personal experience with that, not for myself, but within my brother and sister, but also looking at sort of the other thing is the kids against the kid in a sport such as triathlon, which is an individual sport, can be really detrimental. And so it needs to be evened out. And I see a lot of kids, and in some places it works, but a lot of children, they fall out of the sport, they fall out of the love of the sport, because they come to, there's a group of kids at their own age, and somebody's like, I'm better than you at doing this, I'm better than you at doing that, I'm better than you at doing this sort of thing. And it puts a lot more pressure on. And what I found was actually introducing sort of 3 or 4 or 5 adults into that same session, meant that they would actually be, oh, there's an adult there, I'll train with them. And it really sort of, let's say, took out the bitching between the actual, their teenagers or the youngsters. And therefore, there was always somebody to be running with or trying to beat, but they were always older than them as an adult. So therefore, they would develop and keep on developing, keep on developing. There was no competition in the actual training session. And I think when you have a group of kids, a group of young adults or teenagers, adolescents, they're always trying to get high up the pecking order. That's human nature. Yeah, but when you put somebody who's already in that pecking order, then they don't tend to fight against it.
That's really interesting. So essentially, you modify the environment that they train in order to improve the quality of the training.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, in any club, it's like sort of one of the things that I noticed when we first came. So we set up, I was coaching Triathlon Catalan, a triathlon club in Perpignan, when we first got here. And I was a coach, I was the head coach there for 14 years. In that time, we set up a school of triathlon. And obviously, some parents would come along and go, right, okay, there's my kid, look after him. Yeah, other parents were there like, no, you're not pushing him harder. If not pushing, go on, let's push him harder, push him harder, push him harder. Can we not do more? And then again, it's like sort of it's that sort of environment. It's quite awkward. And obviously, as kids are growing up, that's not good. It influences them and bullies them to a certain extent. Mm. Where I think you integrate them into real life. Yeah, then I think you will find that eliminates. And I say, if you had a load of adults, it's not going to happen in schools. If you had adults learning with kids, there will be nowhere near the same bullying as what there is if there is just a group of kids at the same time. And every group of children, there'll always be somebody who's higher up, and then we'll always pick on the person underneath, or in theory underneath them. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's not pleasant.
That's a really, really interesting observation. What strategies have you developed over the years talking to parents, over-eager parents that want their kids to do well?
Yeah, one of the best things, they tend to do this in France, because in France, Wednesday afternoon is to do with sport. So when Wednesday afternoon comes along with sport, they tend to just sort of, okay, get on with it. And literally, it is sort of the parents, just get told, okay, this is what we're doing, you go away. And so the parents don't have any interaction at all, with that. So, and I know I've seen, obviously, coach in swimming, your parents be sat on the pool side the whole time through. Where when we came to France, there was no parents around at all, and that really did make a difference. So they didn't know what their children were up to while they're actually doing that training session, so they couldn't give their influence. However, when it came to racing, that was a different thing. They'd be there shouting and screaming, etc. Kids, and I've seen adults. I've seen adults in sport do lots of very, very strange things for their kids or against their kids. I mean, I've seen a coach and a parent fighting on the side of the pool. Yeah, I mean, fists fighting on the side of the pool. Yeah, things like that, because there's always that my Billy's better than that. My Billy should be doing this, and my Billy should be doing that. And the same, it's not pleasant, and that environment needs to be sort of eliminated as best it possibly can. So that's the best way, is really to take the parents out of that situation. Mm. And it's the same when Sam was racing. Sam went away to a altitude training center, a school that's based in altitude. And then when they went to competitions, there was no parents there. There was just the people looking after them. Yeah. And obviously they then have the race, or they had a bad race, they had a good race, et cetera, et cetera. You don't get the parents shouting and screaming, why did you do this? Why did you do that sort of thing? Trying to tell them off. Yeah, it's irrelevant.
One thing that stood out to me spending those few days with you guys is we always talk about long-term development, but you have numbers on it. You still have, you know, Sam as a 3-5 year plan still to go through to potentially to reach his full potential. When did that plan start for you? Did you write it in 2019? Was it written before that? Has it always been in the background?
It's never been written. It's adaptable. I don't like writing. If you see my writing, you understand why I don't like writing. I would say it is. It's obviously that development comes through, and probably when Sam started to come back home and start coaching when he was in sort of nine. When I started coaching when he was 19, it was then sort of right. Okay, let's look at this as a realistic thing. Now Sam was a youngster going straight into Ironman distance racing. Yeah, and everybody's like, oh no, you can't do this. You can't do this. You've got to be 32. You've got to be over this age. You've got to be over that age. And we've always known from a very, very young age that Sam had this ability, this endurance and strength ability to keep on going. So it's human nature that obviously our bodies are always adapting. Yeah, we're still growing, or Sam's still growing. So therefore, he's going to get strong. He's only going to get stronger. He's only going to get stronger. So therefore, we're trying to make him the best that he possibly can for when his body's at its strongest, which is obviously a long way down the actual line. So say 26, 28 is where he's going to be at his probably physical peak. But then that's when that physical peak is then going to carry on till he's 32, 34, maybe 35. Yeah. Before then the body starts starting to slow back down again. So obviously my plan is to get him as high as he possibly can by the time he's as strong as he possibly can, maintain it there, and then carry on going as long as he wants to carry on going. Yeah, so it's the same with Jake at the moment. I'm not, if he doesn't do a race this year, he doesn't do this or he doesn't do that, it's relatively irrelevant because it's not about this year. Yeah, it's about what he wants, which is to be a professional athlete. And if being a professional athlete, you need to make a living. And that's going to be making a living when you're older, not when you're actually younger.
Yeah. One of the things that stood out when it comes to that long-term development plan with Sam, and correct me if I'm off, but it seemed like there's still a number of elements in Sam's training that just haven't been touched or optimized at all, almost by design, in the sense that it leaves room for growth later on. Is that the case?
Well yes, but you can't you can't develop everything at once. It's impossible. Some things always got to give. And so that's the whole thing. We've got to look at this when we actually get there. Yeah, it's the same as one of the reasons you were here with Andrew and Luke, and that look at sort of respiratory issues and strengths. And this is something that I've looked at for a long time. And I knew Sam would not use his full lung capacity while he's actually racing or training. And so we've now got to a stage of where, okay, will this actually help? Yeah, I think it's the right time to actually develop this and do that. And obviously, I don't sort of plan this from years before. Yeah, we look at that and go through, okay, we are here now. Where do we think, where are we going to get the best bang for buck? Can we do this? Can we develop this? Can we do that? Yeah, and then develop that forward. And it's the same sort of thing. Sam's always been a very, very strong cyclist. He's always been, well, he hasn't always been a very good strong swimmer. Again, that came from sort of when he was a youngster. He hardly swam. He probably swam once or twice a week. Same as Jake, only swims once or twice a week. But I adapted their stroke to be sort of an adult stroke, and they get their strength. So when they become an adult, they understand what they're actually doing. They're not just turning their arms around. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that then meant Sam then had this big jump in his ability to swim with the big guys. And it's the same sort of cycling. And he's sort of, we've obviously looked at swim, cycle, and then we're looking at running. He's running has always been his least favorite, yeah, of the actual sports itself. And it was the same for me. Running was probably the hardest thing for me as an actual athlete, but I'd learned to love the running, but it took a long, long process. Yeah. And I'm quite happy to take that long process, yeah, through that. And as long as Sam can still see that, yeah, okay, we're going to keep his strength of swimming, we're going to keep his strength of cycling, and still carry on developing his strength of cycling, because there's still more to have out of that. and then carry on slowly progressing the running at the same time. Then obviously, then it will come down. I mean, it came to fruition at Kona this year. So running a 2:42 whatever marathon, yeah, off the bike, it was a super fast time to run off a super strong bike. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and obviously, if he did a super strong bike, averaging sort of 320 watts, and we can up that, and he can still run a 240 marathon, then how fast is he going to get?
Mm-hmm. Collaboration is a term that you used multiple times already to talking about the coaching relationship that you develop with your athletes. Does that happen through, you know, daily training with Sam, or do you sometimes put time aside, sit down, and talk about those longer perspectives and those long, bigger plans?
No, every few months we sit down and talk about everything. I mean, we sit down on a weekly basis and talk about training, how last week went, or how the last 2 weeks went, how we can develop, how we're thinking about the races coming in. There's always that communication away, and that sort of, we have communication. We have dad, and we have coaching time. Yeah, I mean, my coaching time, I see Sam down at the dinner table, the breakfast table, whatever, and look at his eyes and look at his mannerisms, see how he actually is, and adapt training over that. But outside of that, then we have sort of the coaching aspect where we'll sit down and go through different areas. He listens to a lot of podcasts, he reads a lot, everything else, and he hears a lot of ideas. He's also sort of speaking to other athletes, other coaches, other developers, et cetera, and we just bring that in. Then at the beginning of the year, I mean, I've probably got one here, a sheet with what the actual plan is for that year of where we want to be and what sort of numbers he should be pushing out and trying to try and get to. And that's the goal. It's not, for me, at the end of the day, it's not about the race. Yeah, the race is the cherry on the cake. But obviously, what I want to do is I want Sam to be able to hold such and such wattage by this time. Yeah, I want him to be able to run at this pace off this bike at this time. Yeah, so my training is to do that. Yeah, not really about the people he's racing against. Yeah, if somebody then comes along and beats him, and so therefore they've done a better, then fair play to them. They've done an amazing, amazing job.
How much has this whole process changed in the last few months after Sam's success in Kona?
The process for me hasn't changed that much, to be honest. The process for Sam has obviously, he's saying his own words. He was a triathlete that sort of swam, biked, and run. So it was basically swim, bike, run, train, sleep, eat, etc. through the day. Now it's not. It's a lot of social media stuff. There's a lot of sponsorship commitments, everything else like that. And his team's had to grow. Yeah, so we are a team. Say Michelle, myself, Jake, his girlfriend, his manager. We're all a team of people. We have the doctor behind us. We have a nutritionist behind us. We have two kinesiologists behind us. Everything else, all of that there is development as an actual team, and it's getting that team together. And that's one of the things. And that's one bit of advice I'd say with any sort of new any athlete, even if it's an age group or not, you've got to have a team of people. You can't do it by yourself. Even though it's an individual sport, you really can't do it by yourself. You've got to get everybody else to try and help you, get them on board with your goal, with your dream, and actually try and make that viable. Yeah, it's not all, I've got to go and do this today, I've got to go and do that. It's, if you have a question, ask somebody and you'll get an answer back, hopefully.
If let's take a triathlete, let's say that they're well supported by a coach, in the three disciplines, what is the most important person to add to a team for someone who wants to kind of move up and try to enhance their training, their recovery, and everything else?
Somebody to take away probably the daily the support. Yeah, somebody to there to actually support, to say they're doing the right thing, they need doing this, or I need to go and get this done. Okay, I'll go and do that. And then Michelle, my wife, is absolutely fantastic with that. She's brilliant. She's if it wasn't for her, our business wouldn't run, but also Sam wouldn't be at the same level he's at the moment, because it's there. If there's anything that needs doing, you need a troubleshooter, let's say a troubleshooter, to actually go, okay, is this right? Okay, how can we solve that? My job's quite straightforward coaching him. Sam's job is relatively straightforward. Yeah, just doing the actual sessions and the rest of the time relaxing. Mm-hmm. Now his girlfriend has come on board as well, Flo, and again, it's another brilliant person that we can actually use and sort of take everything away. So the more you can take away from you as an actual athlete, the better. Yeah, so you can then just actually recover. But I'd say, yeah, it's having a troubleshooter in the background, no matter what that is. They can then find a physiotherapist, they can find a nutritionist, they can find this, yeah, and then can build that time. But it doesn't actually have to be you as an athlete that tries to find that.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. Talk about your own learning process. And as you said at the very beginning of this conversation, you are very observant. You listen. One thing that stood out to me in the few days that we spent together was when there was some discussion / debate going on amongst the team, you were at your most attentive, I would say, in those moments, and really trying to pick out what was standing out and trying to get the most out of it. Did you always learn like this, or is that something that you've developed over the years?
No, that's what I've always learned like that. I'm not a person to a study person. I'm not somebody to go to university and go, okay, I'm going to learn this. I'd much rather, we could call it laziness, that I'd much rather sort of listen to an expert and go, oh, they've just said that, I might be able to use that. Oh, let me use this. Yeah. But the same as in a sort of a coach. Yeah, I've got to look at my athletes. I've got to look at things, and just I might not say anything, but I observe that and then develop. And I suppose it's a hobby now for me. Yeah, I'm walking down the street, looking at people, how they walk. Yeah, how they do things. It fascinates me. And go, oof, that person's going to have a bad back when they're older. Oof, that person is. Yeah, and just sort of observing that part of it. Yeah, I'm much more a practical learner. And it's one of the things that I use as coming from a sports background and coming from sort of a military background as well. I wouldn't learn from sort of a book. I would learn by doing it myself. Yeah. And then adapting that. Now I'm at an age now where I can't carry on doing the stuff that I give to Sam. So I use the athlete and that. I've probably learned recently to read how the actual athlete is finding that actual session instead of me actually feeling how that session is.
Mm-hmm. Do you have, off the top of your head, do you have a few questions that you ask yourself that you haven't found the answer to yet? Some of the bigger questions regarding triathlon training, or some very specific questions?
I don't think I'm that intelligent to think that far in front. it comes across again. There's not. I don't have sort of. Oh, I've got to find this answer. I've got to find that answer. It's very adaptive. It's very, let's say, holistic. It happens when he actually arrives around there. If there's any, and I think that sort of, we've learned that within business and running this business itself, you can come across a brick wall, and you're not going to go anywhere. Yeah, so you've got to find a way around that brick wall. You might be over it, you might be under it, you might be taking it down, knocking it down, et cetera, et cetera. You've got to find a solution, and it's understanding that. And again, that's one thing I think a lot of people don't do. Yeah, they literally come to this issue and they sit behind that, oh, I can't, yeah, well, that's it, I can't do it. Yeah, they don't find an actual answer. And I think, to be honest, I think I've had this from a young age. If somebody says, you can't do that, then I'll probably have a go at doing it. Yeah, and find a way of actually doing that. The amount of times, like coming out to France, setting this business up, oh, that's not going to work, you're stupid, that's not do this, et cetera, et cetera. And you're like, well, let's wait and see. Yeah, okay, I might fail at it, but at least I failed to try to do something. It's the same with the sort of coaching. We come to the point, I want to make my athletes, I want to make Sam especially, sort of the best athlete in the world. So obviously we're going to keep on coming to sticking points. And once we come to that sticking point, we've got to find a solution and to get around that level until we find sort of the limits of what Sam can do. Yeah, and it's the same with sort of Arthur as well. It comes to an issue, or there's this issue. Okay, how can we adapt that? How can we change that to get the actual area? And I think with all of my athletes, my age group athletes and stuff like that, it's the same thing. They have lots of difficulties in life, within families, within jobs, within just being social, fitting it in training. And we've got to find a solution of how to get them to carry on improving. Yeah, it's not sort of this, oh, you do this, you'll carry on, but I can't do this. Oh, well, then give up. For me, it doesn't work.
And I guess that's one of the ideas. That was one of the ideas behind the week that was set up with Sam, yourself, I guess the Sam's whole team, but also Andrew Sellers, Luke Way. We had Volchek, we had Tomek, we had Michael and myself come over. Out of this week, what were your main takeaways from that week? Maybe things that you have a refreshed perspective on, or things you maybe changed your mind on. What have you taken out of this week?
The taking out of it is obviously there is a solution for sort of the respiratory, and it's an area that I think a lot of people can actually benefit and improve. And I'm learning at the same time. Obviously, they're all experts at what they do. Yeah, I'm not that expert. So obviously, taking that information and adapting that and having them on my side, yeah, and our side, means that if I have another question and develop, yeah, obviously to improve sort of Sam's lung function in racing and sort of in general life, which will then have sort of what I feel have a reduced injury risk later on, especially, then obviously that will help develop, make him a better athlete, etc. So yeah, I picked up, and it's an ongoing process. I just had Andrew text me this morning to see how his spirometry levels are going up, and how that level of adaptability is improving. And yeah, so it's really about sort of looking, has this idea I've possibly seen an area that we could improve, is that possible? Is it? Has it got legs to actually improve? And obviously, the week we had here with everybody, yeah, it's possible to improve. And again, it was great for me to have now developed those contacts, those person, be friends with those people, so they can help us develop Sam to be the best person possible and increase the size of the team.
Mm-hmm. Another aspect of this whole week was passing it on, as you called it, and not being. And not restricting the access to information, just like I guess you learn from, you know, other coaches, podcast conversations. One thing that we did is we filmed almost. I tried to film as much as I could to be released and available openly. Why do you think it's important for that open information to be shared openly?
Again, I learned that. For me, I learned that way. Yeah, so I think it's an important part. Other people also learn that way. Yeah, and it's like I'm much rather, we have nothing to hide in what we actually do. Yeah, Sammy is an athlete because I have taken lots of information. He's a fantastic athlete. I've taken information and adapt my athletes as well to take the information I've got from other people. Mm. So it would be wrong for me to hold that back. Yeah, that information is not me that's thinking about those ideas. It's sort of, oh, that person said that, could that work? Yeah, that might work, and just bring it back in. It's a bit like making a cake recipe. At the end of the day, you sort of, oh, I'll take this. Does that work? Yeah, that works. That's the best cake in the world. Yeah, and it's sort of you don't think, oh no, my cake, get off it. Nobody's touching it. Yeah, it's not about that. It is about sort of passing that information on. When it's, I think it's vital that coaches pass on their information as much as possible. And I unfortunately, I think in today's society, there's more and more athletes, more and more coaches that are trying to make as much money out of the actual sport itself, and sort of, oh, okay, no, I'm going to do this. Oh, no, I'm going to do this. No, you're already going to see a little bit of it. Look, there's the pen. Yeah, there's it gone again now. Yeah, and giving that little teaser across. I'm not mentioning any names at all, but I'm sure most people who know the sport of triathlon will know where I'm talking about. And it's like sort of, well, hang on a minute. Yeah, it's all to do with science. Yeah, it's all to do with developing, making somebody healthier, making somebody better. Yeah, why shouldn't it be open to everybody?
If you had a hope, what do you hope people will get out of the content that we were able to film, whether it's coaches, athletes? Do you have an underlying idea behind it that you hope people get out of it?
No, I mean, each person. I mean, I listen to different podcasts and different things, not because it sort of or read different books, because it's a subject within the sport, but also I don't know what I'm going to get out of that book. Yeah, I'll just hopefully get something. I might not get anything. Yeah, and that happens quite often in cases, and quite often in podcasts, etc., etc. So I'm sure people are going to listen to it and go, oh, yeah, I didn't think about that. Let's have a look at this. Yeah, oh, I didn't think about that. What we did was groundbreaking. None of it was, oh, this has never been seen before. This is the, yeah, it wasn't to do with that at all. It was just looking at one aspect of the sport, yeah, and how to actually develop a person to make them better. And hopefully that they might go, oh, yeah, never thought of that. That's what I'm actually after.
Yeah, that's really great. I like it. Talk a little bit, Richard, about the retreat center, the sports retreat center that you guys run, and how you initially started that and how it's going today.
So we run a triathlon training base in Amelie-les-Bains in the south of France. We've been here now 22 years. Athletes come to us from one day all the way up to a year, or maybe more than a year if they want to, on an actual training camp. And they live with us. They live in our house, they feed, they eat with us, etc., etc. It's not your standard training camp that you go to out in Lanzarote or out in New York or places like that, where it's based within a hotel, you see the coach and that's it. You are actually living the whole time. So you'll sit down, you have lunch with us, you have dinner with us, and that's the benefit. Michelle is a great sort of host and an understanding of what we actually need, as well as running the actual business itself. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it sort of, you live the life as a pro while you're actually with us. And it's developed. And when we first started, we did lots of different questionnaires. Well, Michelle did, not me, sort of question business research and everything else, and sent questionnaires out. And people were sort of, oh, yeah, we would want this, and we want that, and we want this, and we would have this many people, etc. So, for example, one of the areas was sort of for the food, the nutrition side of it. Most people wanted to be self-catering. Yeah. Yet now we don't get anybody who's self-catering at all. Yeah, they come in the food, because it's designed for them. Yeah, it's healthy, it's good food. It's not your normal hotel food that you actually get because you're living in a home. It's home-cooked food.
Yeah,
and that's one of the actual developments that has happened over that period of time. I would say, yeah, some people go on half board for like a day, and that's literally it the rest of the time. Athletes come out to us. If they have a coach, I'll either deal with the coach or deal with the athlete itself and go, okay, this is the structure for the week, this is what we want to do, I want to be able to do this amount of miles, I want to do this amount of kilometers. Then we'll actually I'll take that and actually develop that training session. And 90%, a bit less now, but I'll train with them permanently. So I'll go out on the bike, I'll show them around where the area is, I'll go take a run, I'll go to the track, we'll do this. And it's the same. It's like sort of we've got people in now, and if obviously Sam's got a training session, we're going to the running track, then we'll adapt the training so they come to the running track as well, so they can train with Sam. Mm. Not with him, but within sort of that area. And same with Archer and my other sort of pro athletes that are around here. So it's very sort of homely, let's say, as I'm sure you know. It sort of gives a home environment, and which is nice. It's not sort of a sterile, or not sterile, but sort of hotel-based sort of, oh, I finished now, let's go and sit in my room tomorrow morning, or I'll go to the bar and sit in my room. We don't. We sort of sit around the dinner table chatting, or sit on the sofas chatting about, like, watching TV, watch a film together, et cetera, et cetera. It's real life.
What are some of the challenges of running such a business with your family?
It's full on. It's very, 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 very full on. I feel sorry. For me, obviously, I can go out cycling and go out running and go out swimming and things like that. So I get to do the enjoyable parts. Michelle sort of it gets to do the sort of the ugly parts, well, let's say, sort of doing sort of the cooking, the cleaning, etc. And people feel that that's what she does, that's her job. It's not her job. She then also does all the paperwork, as well as organize the triathlon we run as well. And it's just like sort of the circus act, keeping sort of the plates going at the same time, running around trying to keep them going the whole time through. There's no break. There is no break within that. I mean, now what we've decided to do over this next year is we're taking a lot less, if any, new clients on. So they're taking athletes that I know or athletes that I actually coach. Because it's getting to a stage now, especially with Sam, where I'm traveling. So I'm left, right, and center. He's finding that sort of block. And then when I come back, if I get a new athlete, and it takes a lot of effort to me to learn that new athlete that I've never met before, don't really coach, etc., have any influence. So it means that I've got to just carry on sort of developing them at the same time.
Mm-hmm. No, that's fair enough. Richard, it's been a great pleasure, one, spending those few days with you guys.
It was great to have you. It was good to meet you.
At the end of March, it was really nice. Like you said, a homely environment is well described, or describes well what you guys have set up. And it was very eye-opening for me to be in that environment and share all these ideas with the group that was there. If people want to find out more about you and what you do, where can they find you online?
They can go to www.sanctuary-sportis.com and you'll find our actual website there, or just a Google triathlon training camps in the south of France, and we normally come up relatively high up there. Or Google Sam Laidlaw on the website, and we're linking through that as well at the same time. I don't really do a huge amount with social media. That's not my remit. I have enough time. I have a busy time coaching to be doing influencing people from pictures, etc. But yeah, so I would say probably look through the website is the best way to get in contact with us.
Well, perfect. I'll make sure to link those in the description below. Richard, thanks so much again.
My pleasure. My pleasure at all. Good to speak to you.
Take care.
Okay, and you. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to this episode. If you would like to support the podcast, please take a few moments to leave a written review and a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts. If you want to watch this episode again, you can find the full video recording on my YouTube channel. You'll also find hundreds of hours of free content, all my podcasts, my thoughts of the day, structured presentations, and more. So don't wait, go subscribe, and I'll see you in the next episode. Take care.